little later this morning, three people will charge me on behalf of the seminary, a student, a faculty member, and a staff member who's also an alum, because I hope that they, in some small way, represent the many people who have put their trust in me. This breaks with some tradition. Usually it's one person, but I allowed myself a little leeway. Thank you also to all those who agreed to be part of this service for lending your hearts and your gifts. Thank you especially to two people who have worked with me on a daily basis recently, my intrepid new administrative secretary, Laura March, and a woman who needs little to no introduction to most people in this room, Fran Schnurla, who ably served as the backbone of the field education office for nearly 25 years. Fran, thank you for being here the day after you retired. We just couldn't time it exactly right. And thank you to my faithful and loving spouse, Sarah, and my two little ambassadors of love and hospitality, Abigail and Matthias. Thank you for walking this journey with me, for tolerating long hours and lots of stress, for moving halfway across the country, starting life all over, and for grounding me with music, puzzles, games, tickle fights, home-cooked meals, and lots and lots and lots of books. She listens very well during sermons. They grew up with me in the pulpit. I'd also like to thank the students who took part in a very intense January term intensive course on teaching the Bible to church, the Psalms. This address would not be what it is literally without you. Indeed, I'd like to start with those brilliant students. You see, though I introduced Psalm 116 as a Thanksgiving psalm, in truth, both my J-term students and many prominent biblical scholars have difficulty pinpointing this psalm. When I asked my students to utilize genre categories to describe Psalm 116, their responses were all over the place. Lament, thanksgiving, hymn of praise, wisdom, liturgical. And indeed, in some ways, it is all of these. It shares similar sentence structure and word usage with some laments. It includes some words like the simple that usually occur in wisdom literature. It obviously contains prominent liturgical elements, the cup of salvation. And it is one of the Hallel Psalms, so called because they include to varying degrees the call to praise, hallelujah, translated in the NRSV as praise the Lord, but in the translation we heard this morning, praise the Holy One. With all of this swirling around and a seemingly confusing poetic movement from idea to idea, no less than the prominent German psalm scholar Erhard Gerstenberger agreed with my students when he wrote, "The structure of this psalm seems haphazard." J. Clinton McCann said it with more detail when he wrote that the traditional elements of a song of thanksgiving are present, but they seem to be presented in no particular order. Scholars disagree on the structure of this psalm. Indeed, Psalm 116, like so many psalms, defies our attempts to categorize it. So often in life and in scholarship, it is both tempting and natural for us to want to label something, to understand it by controlling it. But as with the people in our lives and the person who wrote this text, Psalm 116 resists our attempts to, as poet laureate Billy Collins once wrote, tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it, beating it with a hose to find out what it really means. Thank God for a text that reminds us of the violence our attempts to control so often inflict. At the same time, this poem was written down from an oral tradition, preserved for posterity. It has been recited by millions of people across thousands of years, translated into dozens of languages, sampled and sung and cried over. People have stolen a verse or a phrase from it and written that verse or phrase onto the deepest recesses of their souls in order to get them through tough times. In short, this poem does have meaning to the people who come looking for meaning. So then, as we are coming looking for meaning here in this preaching moment, what might this poem mean for us? I'd like to humbly suggest that it is something to say to lay people sitting in pews and standing in protest, to pastors who seek to guide them, to chaplains comforting those under their charge, to marriage and family therapists looking to mend and encourage relationships, to regional and national denominational bodies, and even to those of us involved in this crazy endeavor we call theological education. I'd like to suggest that this poem has something to say to us about what it means to be spiritually formed into a hospitable community. Now, I just said a lot there to a lot of people, so maybe it'd be helpful if I give a little structure to the rest of what I'm going to say. I'd like to look at this psalm through the practice of psalm singing. I'd like to look at it in a way that highlights how it is used as a whole, because when we sing a psalm, we are engaging in a holistic way. We are engaging it with our whole body minds, as John Dewey liked to say, with everything that makes us who we are, our bodies, our brains, our senses, our relationships, our memories, our whole lives. This is integrative work. Instead of dissecting the psalm, I hope to add layer upon layer of meaning. Instead of dissecting it, which we so often do with texts, torturing them to get meaning, I hope to let the psalm live by living it. I hope to do so by engaging it in three ways: as a song, as a poem, and as a prayer. So let's start with song. We just sang Richard Smallwood's stirring musical version of the first two verses. I love the Lord who heard my cry. At the end of Psalm 116, the psalmist calls us to praise the Holy One and to do so in community. So what do we do when we sing a psalm together? Well, let's start from an evolutionary perspective. Brian Boyd, in his book, Why Lyrics Last, explores the rhythm of ritual chant and song and how it produces both emotional attunement, that's group feeling, and physical entrainment, group acting. Regarding emotional attunement, Boyd gives the example of the staccatoed rhythm of the Maori chanters who bond by singing together in chant before they go out to fight. Similarly, on the other end of the emotional spectrum, we can think of monks who chant the Psalms regularly together. Their breath and their whole bodies and even their emotions start to become attuned to each other. As for physical entrainment, Boyd points out that just as we walk more smoothly in a steady rhythm, think soldiers walking to a particular left, right step, so we perform group actions far better with a steady shared rhythm, hence work songs for sailors, boatmen, and chain gangs. Like most social animals, singing helps us do things together. But that's not all it does. Archaeologist Stephen Mithin, in his book The Singing Neanderthals, claims that there is some evidence that music can even make our brains operate together. He cites the work of jazz musician and cognitive scientist William Benson, who talks about the coupling that can happen when people synchronize the sounds and movements they make. They enter similar emotional states and hence attune their nervous systems to each other. Anyone who has played or sung in an ensemble has had the opportunity to experience this musical flow. When we sing as with others and are no longer able to distinguish our voice from all the rest. Rather than sharing information with each other in a musical manner, this is actually making a common sound. Mithin further cites neurobiologist Walter Freeman, who asserts that the hormone oxytocin, and you can clock out for about 10 seconds here, but I'm going to read it anyway. The hormone oxytocin may be released into the basal forebrain, and that, by loosing the synaptic connections in which prior knowledge is held, clears the path for the acquisition of new understanding through behavioral actions that are shared with others. This is biotechnology of group formation. Essentially, when we sing together, a chemical is released in our brain that enables us to actually be more open to other people. Other studies have backed up the notion that music enables us to bond with others. In one study, musicians perform better on what is called the cocktail party problem. That is, the ability to listen to, focus on, and comprehend another person amidst great noise and distraction. In another study, participants were most accurate at identifying other people's emotions when they heard other people's voices compared to when they looked at facial expressions alone or even facial expressions and emotion and voices combined. The eyes may be the window of the soul, but our vocal boxes are the front door. But making music together, as we all know, does not automatically bond people. Sometimes music is so strange to us, so culturally other, that there are factors that inhibit our ability to engage in it. Or maybe we're afraid or uncomfortable with the people who are making it. So Thomas G. Long reminds us that music is the nuclear reactor of the congregation. It is where much of the radioactive material is stored, where a good bit of the energy is generated, and alas, where congregational meltdown is most likely to occur. This is a struggle for faith communities, for denominations, for theological seminaries, particularly ecumenical ones. Indeed, cognitive neuroscientist Anirudh Patel argues that music has an indeterminate meaning. Not all cultures experience particular sequencing of notes in the same way. And music does not automatically create similar feelings in all of us. Oddly and completely unintentionally, Patel is echoing an argument made by no less than John Calvin 500 years ago. Calvin used to call music an unknown tongue because of its indeterminate meaning. Calvin preferred music and worship to have words so that all could agree on the meaning. Now, Calvin, as he so often did, took this argument to some unhelpful extremes, but maybe for now it's best that we heed his words and turn to considering the words of this psalm, that is, the psalm as a poem. So we start again with Brian Boyd. In Why Lyrics Last, Boyd notes that poems, and particularly lyric poems, that is, poems without narrative structure, make meaning differently from stories. In narratives, Boyd writes, poets describe the characters from the outside. In drama, the characters speak for themselves. In lyric, poets or others speak in their own voice, often untrammeled by a narrative situation. Boyd argues that poetry creates a compact between the poet, potentially at her most private and unconstrained in subject and direction, and the reader at his most focused, ready to follow the unpredictable course of the poet's thoughts as suggested by the poet's words. A rare intimacy across a great gap between the poet at the moment of composition and the reader at the moment of reading. Poetry is so powerful because it does not distance us from its author as much as other forms of writing do. In fact, when we recite poetry, as Psalm scholar Rolf Jacobson argues, we actually take on the persona of the person who wrote the words. We don't just act like the person, as we would in a drama, but rather because we must bring so much of our own experiences and emotions to poetry that does not give details of plot or setting or even the characters, we end up speaking the words of the poem ourselves and importing many of our emotions. Now, the difficulty with this, as Jacobson notes elsewhere, is that it can produce cognitive dissonance when our current emotions do not match the emotions of the psalm. Cognitive dissonance occurs when we hold two or more inconsistent thoughts or experiences. For instance, when we drive over an hour to work, as Rolf Jacobson would say, but actively hate the act of driving. Or when a person knows that smoking negatively impacts their health and keeps smoking. Jacobson cites the three commonly acknowledged ways of reducing this dissonance. Changing attitude, I actually don't mind driving. Adding new thoughts, I'm willing to drive if I can support my family. Or changing behaviors, get a different job. Jacobson argues that cognitive dissonance can be used as a pedagogical tool to help people to move between emotional states and even to gain empathy for those different from them. But it might also be helpful to consider what theologian and educational theorist James Fowler calls conjunctive faith in his classic book, Stages of Faith. Now, many have argued with the idea of distinct stages in faith formation and development, which seem to move in a stair-step manner. I'm not going to talk about that today. I'm concerned with the argument here that Fowler calls conjunctive faith, just with this specific instance of what he's describing. He says, conjunctive faith can realize that the behavior of life, of light, requires that be understood as both a wave phenomenon and as particles of energy. It's both. A person with conjunctive faith can both hold their beliefs strongly and also celebrate, reverence, and attend to the wisdom evolved in things as they are before seeking to modify, control, or order them to fit prior categories. Conjunctive faith resolves cognitive dissonance by saying, both of these are true. Fowler articulates this as the difference between a kind of knowing that he learned in seminary, in which he employed language studies, source criticism, form criticism, and text criticism in order to crack open texts like a nut, and the kind of knowing that he learned later when undertaking St. Ignatius's spiritual exercises, when he was not required to give up or negate critical skills, but to supplement them with a method in which he learned to relinquish the initiative to the text. He writes, instead of my reading, analyzing, and extracting the meaning of a biblical text, In Ignatian contemplative prayer, I began to learn how to let the text read me and to let it bring my needs and the Spirit's movements within me to consciousness. Conjunctive faith, and I'm quoting a little bit at length here from Fowler, accepts that truth is more multidimensional and organically interdependent than most theories or accounts of truth can give. Religiously, it knows that the symbols, stories, doctrines, and liturgies offered by its own or other traditions are inevitably partial, limited to a particular people's experiences of God, and incomplete. Fowler equates this kind of faith with what Paul Ricoeur called second naivete. That is, a person with this kind of faith knows how to critique what they believe, to dissect theological statements and biblical texts, but also wants to see all of this whole, and to again become grasped by the power of rituals, symbols, liturgy, music. Now, what does that have to do with Psalm 116? Well, I wouldn't have seen the connection without my students from the J-Term course, thank you once again, who noted that Psalm 116 includes a word normally found in wisdom literature. In verse 6, the psalmist, in the middle of praising God for being gracious and merciful and righteous, suddenly says, "The Holy One protects the simple." The simple. Now, some translations render this word simple-hearted or gentle in heart, but this is just not what the word usually means. In most other places in Scripture, particularly in Proverbs, the simple are those who lack God's wisdom. They are, as the Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon puts it, naive. They are easily convinced and easily enticed by others. They're gullible and way too trusting. Normally, biblical writers would be calling upon the simple to grow up already. But here in Psalm 116, God protects the simple. Now, I may be reading way too much into the psalm. Obviously, the psalmist had never read Ricoeur or Fowler. But it's pretty clear that the psalmist was at one point very critical. In verse 12, the psalmist says, "In my terror, I said, everyone is lying." There can be nothing more dissective than parsing what others say until there is no truth, tying someone's words to a chair to beat meaning out of them, only to discover that their words now mean nothing. But somehow the psalmist turns around from considering everyone a liar to desiring to come in the midst of that same community to bring thanksgiving to God, to enact ritual. The psalmist moves from distancing themselves from others toward desiring to enact ritual symbol with others. Another way to put this might be what philosopher and educator bell hooks calls radical openness. Indeed, there are some indications that at its root, this Hebrew word for simple might be related to a cognate word that means open. Someone is way too open-minded and just receives naively. But of course, bell hooks doesn't mean an uncritical openness either. I saw this radical openness at work just the other day. You can tell when I wrote this because the faculty will know what I'm talking about. Just the other day, when the faculty met with some congregations that have been engaging in what my colleague Scott Williamson has been helping us define as restorative justice. One layperson described the experience of participating in a circle process in order to prepare him to embrace a formerly incarcerated person. This layperson realized that in order to be involved in this work, he had to change. When asked to describe what this meant, he said that this change involved sensitivity, honesty, forgiveness, open-mindedness, and compassion. He articulated it in a way that seemed like it was kind of painful, but that the longer he was in the circle, the more compassion, the more openness he experienced. He had to let go of some settled beliefs while retaining others and somehow holding them all together. This is, I would argue, the very nature of poetry, which thrives on juxtaposing things. Specifically, juxtaposing unlike things. That's called metaphor. Placing two things that are unlike into relationship with each other in order to illuminate both. Once again, our patron Reformed theologian, John Calvin, got at this 500 years ago when he argued that psalm singing was important because it involved mutual edification. Different people sharing their experiences from their limited sin-blinkered existence, he would add, in order to provoke greater love for God and others. But this too is difficult. How do we truly hear each other? How do we welcome into community those with whom we disagree or with whom we share so little life experiences? How do we live into communities that can welcome those who doubt, those who are refugees, those who are formerly incarcerated? I believe simply, maybe too simply, that it involves prayer. So let's look at Psalm 116 from that angle. Prayer at its core is vulnerability. It is disclosing to another person the depths of one's emotions. As expressed in Psalm 116, it involves a realization that I cannot save myself. I need help. O Holy One, I pray, save my life. Liturgical theologian Donald Saylors would say that at the core of worship is human pathos and divine ethos. By pathos, Saylors means the human suffering of the world. By divine ethos, he means the characteristic manner in which liturgy is a self-giving of God to us, the encounter whereby grace and glory find human form. Christian liturgy transforms when the vulnerability of human pathos is met by the ethos of God's vulnerability in word and sacrament. Psalm scholar Walter Brueggemann agrees with this when he calls the act of praying the Psalms a dialogical act, in which we expose our dependence upon God, and God is taken to be supple and open, exposed to risk, and placed in jeopardy. God risks by making a primary relationship between ourselves and God prayer, where we ask God for what we want, and God listens. From an educational standpoint, bell hooks calls this the passion of experience, a particular knowledge that comes from suffering, a way of knowing often expressed through the body, what it knows, what it has been deeply inscribed on it through experience. This complexity of experience can rarely be voiced and named from a distance. We can't separate ourselves from this. I think this might be why the lyricist who brought us our final hymn for the day, "When the Poor Ones," could express that it is when the poor, the hungry, the thirsty, the vulnerable are at the center of ministry, are in fact doing ministry, that we know that God still goes this road with us. This is what will help us to greet the stranger as a neighbor. Prayer is vulnerability. Hooks argues that the lived experience of the person articulates something more powerful than even the words they use to convey the message. That is, our very personhood is more articulate than our music or our words. Which is why worship is such a nuclear reactor. In worship, especially in sung poetry, we are activating our own experiences to such a high degree and engaging all of our emotional mechanisms to such a high degree that we become entirely invested in the experience. We become vulnerable. Which is why when we experience hurt in worship, it's so hard for us to re-engage. We have utterly exposed ourselves. Indeed, the Psalms seem to call this vulnerability out of us. I can't help but return to John Calvin. I know. Who normally stoically resisted talking about himself in his published writings. In fact, it is only in his preface to his commentary on the Psalms that he gives any extended autobiography. Somehow he felt that he could not interpret or talk about the Psalms without talking about himself, without sharing about his own vulnerability, suffering, and need. I might say we become greatly mistaken in teaching biblical interpretation if we only focus on the history, the rhetoric, and the theology of a text, particularly if this text is the Psalms, without also considering our personal experiences. But of course, there's a tyranny to experience as well, right? Our experiences can be used to bludgeon others, just as we tortured the text. If we hold our experiences too tightly, we lash out when others disagree with us. And I think there must be something other than fake news or just everybody's opinion, right? Bell Hooks is attentive to this. In classrooms that have been extremely diverse, she writes, where I've endeavored to teach material about groups who are not black, if you didn't know she is a black woman, I've suggested that if I bring to the class only analytical ways of knowing and someone else brings personal experience, I welcome that knowledge because it will enhance our learning. Also, I share with my class my conviction that if my knowledge is limited and if someone else brings a combination of facts and experience, then I humble myself and respectfully learn from those who bring this great gift. But what might this combination of facts and experience, analysis and passion look like? Let me give, as I think only appropriate at this moment, an example from my own life. The first time I encountered Psalm 116 was when the chapel community at the seminary where I went for my MDiv regularly sang the song we sang right before this address. I love the Lord who heard my cry. But that was all I knew of the psalm for many years, just those first two lines. The second time I encountered Psalm 116 was a little over a year ago. And I encountered it because of what happened about 2 years ago. See, on this day, 2 years ago, I was coming home shell-shocked after a sudden one-week stay in the hospital. On this exact day, about 5 hours from now. For reasons still unknown to both me and my doctors, I developed what I thought was a nasty stomach bug, but what the doctors ended up diagnosing as endocarditis, a heart infection. After multiple tests to determine for sure what I was experiencing was endocarditis, and after one particular test that ended with fluid filling my lungs, drowning me from the inside out and landing me in the ICU, the doctors determined that I might be dying and that they needed to intervene right away. They put a PICC line in my arm and started me on a 6-week course of high-dose antibiotics. This after 1 week in the hospital on 2 other high-dose antibiotics. Then they sent me home. When the 6 weeks were over, my heart was clear. They determined that I had conquered whatever was trying to kill me. Soon after, I came here to Louisville to interview, was invited to take up this position, and in July, only months after being given the all clear, moved here to Kentucky. Though I had conquered the disease, it had also conquered me. I began experiencing insomnia. I started having extreme stomach aches. Before the illness, I used to love holding my kids and comforting them when they were sick. After the illness, their slight sniffles would cause a panic attack. Loud noises and big crowds started to overwhelm my senses because my whole body was constantly on high alert. A year ago, on Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, I landed in the ER again with high blood pressure, breathing problems, and chest pain. They monitored me for 3 days and determined that I developed a powerful general anxiety disorder. Every time I heard about somebody who had died or even talked about death, my thoughts would spiral, which meant it was perfect timing that first fall semester when we spent 2 weeks in PTC talking about death and funerals. Sometimes I would end up on the floor crying, reliving the horror and humiliation and loneliness of being in the hospital far from my family, not knowing if I would ever leave. Around that same time, I began seeing a therapist. I realized soon that I had always had a form of significant anxiety, particularly around experiences of life change. But now those problems were exacerbated by a near-death experience, uprooting from rootedness in social relationships, and a new, highly stressful job. The therapist, who was seminary-trained, asked me to look for a Bible verse to help me center myself during panic attacks, to help me stop the cycle of rehearsing my own near-death over and over. I ended up finding Psalm 116, 7 through 9. Return, O my soul, to your rest, for the Holy One has dealt bountifully with you. For you have delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. I walk before the Holy One in the land of the living. When I started working ahead on this spring convocation, I discovered that the daily lectionary psalm for this morning was, in fact, Psalm 116. At first, I avoided it. I couldn't talk about this in front of so many people in an academic address. But the more I lived into it, the more I spent time with the psalms and with my students, the more I realized I couldn't avoid it. Because despite Erhard Gershenberger and J. Clinton McCann saying that this psalm has a haphazard structure, I'm now convinced that the structure is not haphazard. Imagine, as the psalmist invites us to, that the person reciting the psalm was in the very jaws of Sheol, with the snares of death encompassing. Imagine that, like me, they survived that experience. But imagine that perhaps they experienced an anxiety similar to my own. Imagine that they went to worship trying to offer their Thanksgiving offering to God. They began the normal Thanksgiving psalm, which would have started with a call to God, moved into a description of their crisis, and then God's help, and then ended with the call to Thanksgiving and praise. But imagine that as they began to talk about their crisis, their near death, they got wrapped up in that recitation. Their mind became death-haunted. It began to suffocate them. Imagine, in fact, that it took them 3 times to be able to come to articulate full-throated praise, as they finally do in verses 17 through 19. But in order to do so, they had to take a breath and remind themselves to be present in the moment here in the land of the living, not back in the snares of death. Well, in fact, you might end up with the structure of the psalm as it is, which does not proceed by logical storytelling, nor the strict format of a regular Thanksgiving psalm, but in fact, during the first iteration of the Thanksgiving structure, stops, does not say words of thanks, but instead becomes suddenly an internal conversation with the psalmist talking to themselves. Return, O my soul, to your rest. Then they're immediately drawn again to talk about God delivering them from death. They try again to do the Thanksgiving psalm. This time the cycle has been broken, and they can finish it. But they're reminded of death again. Verse 15. But the cycle has been broken, and they can finally voice three verses of full thanks. God has loosed their bonds. They are, even if just for a moment, free from the downward spiral of their anxiety. I think this is even more convincing when one does the rhetorical and textual work, realizing that the word used here for rest is not the word that relates to Sabbath. It does not mean, as Sabbath does, to cease from doing. Instead, it's the root which means to settle down, or as I often prefer to translate it, to abide, to stay in a place for a while. Perhaps I'm stretching to live in the present. Consider also the verb form for the word walk in the phrase, I walk before the Holy One in the land of the living. As Eugene Peterson notes in a sermon on Psalm 116, the Hebrew word for walk used here is conjugated in the hithpael, which he articulates as I walk back and forth, stroll meditatively, instead of the straightforward walking toward a destination. Now, although this understanding emerges from the text, from its structure, from some word study, I would not have been able to get to these text-critical means without my personal experiences. Even as I say that, I'm drawn back to the psalm itself, to the psalmist's inability to articulate in the expected form. I'm reminded of the ethicist Judith Butler, who encourages us to become comfortable with incoherence, enabling us to counter a certain ethical violence which demands that we manifest and maintain self-identity at all times and require that others do the same. She continues, it is still necessary to remember that what qualifies as an articulation and expression of psychic material exceeds narration. Articulations of all kinds have their necessary limits given the structuring effects of what remains persistently inarticulable. To hold a person accountable for his or her life in a narrative form may even be to require a falsification of that life in order to satisfy the criterion of a certain kind of ethics, one that breaks with relationality. We may be preferring the seamlessness of the story to something we might tentatively call the truth of the person. That, to a certain degree, might well become more clear in moments of interruption, stoppage, open-endedness, in enigmatic articulations. Bell Hooks writes that sometimes the mountaintop is difficult to reach with all our resources, factual and confessional. So we are just there collectively grasping, feeling the limitations of knowledge, longing together, yearning for a way to reach that highest point. Even this yearning is a way to know. So too do we find this inarticulacy in our own spiritual tradition. As when in the Epistle to the Romans we read that when we do not know how to pray as we ought, that very Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. A recent trend in both youth ministry and the sociology of religion has been to gauge, even in part, a person's commitment to their faith tradition by their ability to articulate what they believe. I wonder if, as pastors, teachers, chaplains, therapists, theological educators, we are willing to live in the cognitive dissonance that it is both true that being able to articulate one's belief is incredibly important and can be beneficial, and at the same time that perhaps the people with the greatest faith are those who struggle to articulate but keep coming anyway. As Parker Palmer puts it, true prayer brings us to the edge of a great mystery where we become inarticulate, where our knowledge fails. How do we sit with this? How do we come together as a community of difference with articulations and traditions and songs that are different? How do we come together when we cannot even articulate when we are racked with doubts, when we do not even believe. Perhaps simply by abiding, by halaking around, by being patient with each other and comfortable with silence. When Bell Hooks asks her white male colleague Ron Scapp to describe how he navigates situations in which he feels uncomfortable, he responds, "I've cultivated the ability to pause and critically consider my actions. This is the critical practice that makes solidarity possible. Not that we never make mistakes or ever rid ourselves of the fear of being racists or dominators or of simply hurting others by our ignorance. The practice of pausing is a practice of respect. It allows you to acknowledge and access other people's feelings without violating that space with your insistence that you have a right to be there or anywhere you want to be." I suppose it's only appropriate then to dwell here in this moment, to end where I started, with thanks. Thanks be to God, gracious, righteous, merciful. God, you protect the simple. When I was brought low, you saved me. You delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. Here I am, right in front of you, here in the land of the living. O God, may we abide here together because you have been so abundant toward us.